So here we are, and I'm finally ready to share this story. As I mentioned, it's been 5 years since it happened, and there's this crazy thunderstorm coming through, and it just seems like the perfect time. So here we go. Everything in my life before that moment, I had been a quote-unquote ordinary guy. I definitely felt connected to nature as a child, and as many people are, I was brought up in a particular religious lineage. My mother's an ordained deacon in the Episcopal Church, and I was raised with the concept of God and Jesus in mind, but never forcing anything on me. And as I grew up, I never really felt a direct connection into religious practices. I kind of always seemed to sense a bit of separation in what people would just simply tell me through stories, or how we would simply stand up because it was time to stand up, or sing the songs because it was time to sing the song. And I think ritual is wonderful, and I've come to have a deeper appreciation for the place of religion, but it was never really my cup of tea at the time growing up. I would say that when I was a child, like many children, there was definitely a great sense of wonder and creativity about the world, and I, like many of us, played in the woods for hours and hours and hours on end and had countless interactions and stories that seemed somewhat miraculous in the rearview mirror, just interacting with the bugs and the sun and the wind and the moon and the plants and the trees. But I think that's fairly normal for most children who have the ability to access those natural environments. There was nothing that I would have considered a type of exceptionalism in any way. I certainly wasn't good at sports. I tried to play the violin in high school and was on the tennis team, on the swim team. I did wrestling one time until I got a black eye and made my mom cry. And after that, I decided maybe that wasn't the best path. Storm's getting a little crazy, so I'm just going to shut this door. As I grew up, I, like many, was taught about paths forward and career and what success and happiness can and should look like within the confines of everything that I knew. And like many of you, there is a common theme that we've all been passed down generation to generation, parent to child, parent to child, parent to child, at least for our recent memory, in terms of how things worked and what was truly important. And that story and that narrative is that you are here to learn and to achieve. And you do that through acquiring knowledge of books from classes and teachers in places that have structured surroundings, methodologies, processes, so that if you want to achieve the result that others have, that's visible and visual and tangible in the expression as physical things, money, cars, houses, then you follow a path and you're presented with a variety of the flavors of the path. So you might choose to pursue medicine or law or accounting. You might be an archaeologist. That was my kind of initial interest. And then you do that and you go to work and you find some way to express a relationship, potentially build some form of family. And really, those who are the most successful play the game the best and they collect the most pieces. Pieces could be anything, but most often we know it as money. And often it's not said in those exact terms. Often it's 10,000 flavors of a more gentle and softer wording, but the undercurrent is completely consistent, at least for the modern Western society that we all know that many of us were raised in as part of. And so that's the stream of consciousness in which I grew up in and participated in. And I had a desire to be loved and accepted and achieve. And so even with my quirky undertones, I still was able to excel by many of those means, by many of those scorecards. And as I was going through high school, I realized that I had attraction to men, but I had also had a girlfriend. And the only reason that that's pertinent to the story is within the structure in which I had been existing up until that point of time, I had always followed all the rules. I was the head of the integrity council and oftentimes held positions in student council. I was leading our peer coaching groups, you know, communicating, resolving conflict and in high school. And I'd even done, you know, my Eagle Scout stuff, all the things, right, for that type of story. And then suddenly, as I started to really know that aspect of myself, I would say it's something that was ingrained in my being. That was the first time that I realized that I had a truth that might have been divergent at that time, we're talking 1998, from the consensus of what someone should do or be or feel. And so it was the first time that I chose to speak my experience and truth, and that's a whole nother story. But that freedom to express to my family and to my friends and to ultimately change the trajectory of my life led me into other spiritual dimensions of seeking truth and coming closer to that experience of truth that I am to live as this incarnation at this time and this place. And so when I left the University of the South after one semester, again, a whole nother story, I found myself teaching school in Honduras for 1 year with 82nd and 6th graders. They had had a massive hurricane called Hurricane Mitch, and the teachers had left to go home, back to America, those who had been volunteering. Usually a well-credentialed person like me with one semester of college would not have been able to go do what I did, but as the universe presented the opportunity, I had the chance to go down there. And that's also relevant to the story and the journey, in that as I stepped into the truth around my sexual being, I found myself in a new country, knowing no one, not speaking the language, having just gone home long enough to deliver pizza to save $500 for an airline ticket. And suddenly I was in a very chaotic environment in a developing country that had tremendous poverty. And although I had been hired and paid to go teach at a private Episcopal school, it was the first time in my life, as I was in isolation down there, not knowing other people from my previous social networks, that I could get quiet and spend time by myself. And for the first time, without knowing what meditation was, start to follow and trust an inner guidance that was always there. And that inner guidance took me far away from the private school and took me to the public dumps where there was burning mounds of trash and naked children and rancid scenarios of every manner that you might imagine. And every day, it was just a knowingness, not the voice of God, not the clouds parting. It was a knowingness that was the truth of my soul directing me. There was no plan. There was no map. It was walk here. There is work to be done. And some days that work looked like making peanut butter and banana sandwiches and simply handing them out. And other days that looked like trying to find a translator to be able to gather enough scraps and trash to build some semblance of a home for some of these people. But the key to that is that it was all intuitive. And for the first time, I knew that that existence did in fact exist within me and as part of this whole experience. And I didn't label it as anything. I didn't label it as Jesus or God or Krishna or Buddha. It was just what was happening. And suddenly, for the first time, without all these pressures and distractions of my previous world, I was able to choose freely that I could participate as I felt called to do, without judgment, without having to make trade-off decisions of other commitments or to other people. And it was a beautiful lesson in what that freedom can do in terms of the creative reciprocity of the world. But when I came back, I had a challenge. I had sort of unlocked some of this energy and this intuition that was aching to remain free and dying to express itself further. But there was no place for it. I remember coming back and having a conversation with the priest of our church. All I knew at that time was if I wanted to do something intuitive like that, the only path I knew in my world and the way it was presented at that time was something like the church. I didn't have access to these other spiritual communities and paths and people. And so in my smaller world, my wonderful small world, really the only path forward was to work in the church. And I had a conversation when I came back with our priest, just explaining everything that had happened. And his answer was basically, wait, you know, and listen. And I remember my parents, not strong holding, but gently encouraging me to consider the priesthood. And it never felt right, primarily because I couldn't directly relate to the story of Jesus. More on that to come. But at that time, that was my experience. And so I became frustrated. And as I moved back into the city, I was newly out and had not experienced many parts of my sexual identity or relationships. And I was just getting back into college after my glorious one semester I had achieved. And so I kind of fell back to sleep, if we use those words, and I don't use them in a derogatory tone. It's just easy for people to understand in this vernacular as we talk about spirituality. And I would describe a sleep as primarily focusing on gratification using my senses. Again, looking for cookies and accolades around money, around jobs, around social networks, all the things. And with that, less and less freedom to be creatively in tune with my intuition and offer myself as my true self, which we'll come to later. And I think that many of us can relate to this, that we probably had different parts and phases of our life where, due to circumstance or due to timing or due to some inexplainable event, we suddenly find ourselves with much greater freedom. And in the freedom and absence of the pressures in which we are used to, it's quite interesting to see where the natural current of life can start to direct our time and attention and our energy and our efforts and all of our gifts. So I don't feel like any of that was exceptional. I think they were wonderful lessons. And when I went back to sleep, it just means that I couldn't find a way to express truths that I started to unlock that were not fully blossomed within me. It was not a perpetual state. It was moments, brief experiences, but not a re-envisioning of the entirety of who I was or what this experience could be. And so when I said going back to sleep, you know, for the first time ever, I was starting to party with my newfound friends and going out to clubs and bars, which was something new for me. And what I'll say about that period is I think it was wonderful. I think it was beautiful and wonderful. There's nothing that I look at for 1 second that was regretful. I really got to understand for the first time how I could interact with people in new and different ways that I didn't know was possible, you know, and that involves all sorts of scenarios and people and situations. I just only knew how to interact in certain ways, being raised in the time and the place and the way that I was. And those interactions, I also got to experience a broader perspective of my ability to interact with anyone in lots of different forms and formats. There was a freedom there. The club scene at that time had many experiences with MDMA, and I found there to be new depths that I realized in some of those experiences and what a connection with other humans can be. So all of that was very freeing, very eye-opening, transformative in many ways, but I still consider myself asleep because even though I was having these experiences, it was still within the confines of expectation. The key to this, as I share it to be helpful, is that I don't identify in that period of my life as someone who is seeking. You know, I don't see myself during that period of time as someone who was on an overtly spiritual path. I didn't have practices. I didn't have a daily practice for sure, but I didn't even have tools and practices that I could use that now are the staple and cornerstone, the foundation of my human existence. So I wasn't a seeker in that sense. I was an achiever. I was a pleaser. And at a very young age at that time of this story being 22, 23, I had originally had a path of being more altruistic. Since I had had the experience of teaching and working in a developing nation, I had told myself the story that I wanted to get a degree in public health and go to law school to do more of that in some formal official capacity. But as life unfolded, it was 1998 when I graduated high school and the internet was booming. This was right before Google was Google. And I found a lot of internships with companies where I was doing research and odd end jobs. And that kind of became my path throughout college. I did a lot of the traditional stuff. I worked in a restaurant here and there. And those are all very interesting stories. I ended up in Asheville for a year unexpectedly, and the only job I could get was trying to sell life insurance to people. And that's a whole story. I had to work in social services there because there were no jobs right after I graduated college. And that's a whole series of stories. So the point is, you know, life is what it is. It brings what it brings. And my degrees were in political science and sociology. But as I found myself back in Atlanta after Asheville, the interesting work at the time was digital. It was internet marketing. And I had had a number of friends who were starting various types and forms of companies. And through a friend, I got an opportunity to work with a company that was just being born in Atlanta called 360i. It was a very early version of a digital marketing agency, which, of course, they're everywhere now. But this was specifically founded to help people with websites optimize for the search engines. And Google didn't exist. So initially, it was really a focus on Yahoo and some of the others I can't even remember the names of now. And as I did that, I kind of found my knack in that it was immediate gratification. I found the ability to speak to the transition of digital media from passive advertising on billboards to an active process of intuitively allowing people to type in words and that taking them to, into information. And so we take it for granted now, but you have to remember that time. That transition was huge. The idea that a company could speak to an individual who potentially was actually looking for something in that moment versus the only other options being radio advertising and newspapers and billboards. Crazy to think about. So I was able to generate enough interest within myself to tell those stories, and I told them well. And because I found intrigue in that evolutionary process of conveying information, I was emphatically telling the excitement of that transition and how companies could be part of it. And I did well in that. At a very young age, I found myself moving to New York, and that was after Atlanta. And by the age of 24, through incredibly quote-unquote odd circumstances, I had gone from making $18,000 as an intern to, in that particular year, over $400,000, primarily from commissions of things that I was able to bring together. And again, I don't share that because I care as an achievement, but it was this thing that was very unsought after that just seemed to be happening. And if I would kind of get into the flow of what I was doing, I could authentically connect with people. And the beautiful part about that chapter of my journey is that at a very early age, I found myself having disposable income. And at a very early age, I was able to receive the lesson and the wisdom that that was not it. That's not where it was. And so I think money as energy tied to desires and your potential fulfillment of those desires or not is a beautiful, wonderful lesson on the spiritual path. Because all of the game that I had been playing with all the achievement and all the accolades and all the pats on the back was leading me to the belief that I could be free if I had enough money. That was the only freedom that I knew within popular culture. If you want to be free, you control the entirety of your destiny. If you want to control the entirety of your destiny, you do that through earning an obscene amount of money and doing what you want, when you want, how you want. That is the collective cultural story in which I was raised. And many of you who are listening to this, I might imagine, have had some flavor of that. And so at a young age, I was able to break that narrative. I was able to have disposable income and feel my stress and anxiety and tension go way up and realize that those trips and those things to buy didn't satiate me. And so there was no breakthrough moment at that younger age, but it was just a trending pattern of, this isn't it. This is not it. So if this isn't it, is there an it? Gosh, I hope there is an it greater than this. And so as I had those realizations, I had no other option that I knew of at that time. Again, I wasn't part of spiritual communities. I didn't have spiritual friends. Spirituality did not seem like the contextual story in which I grew up that would lead me to freedom and happiness. And I would see things online, you know, about like monks and meditation. And I would hear things like, that's a place of happiness and fulfillment. But I would look at them and I would say, that's so foreign to me. That's so far away. I can never imagine being like that. There might have been a draw to it, but I couldn't accept that would be any type of potential reality that I could play in. And so I just saw it as an interesting novelty, beautiful, interesting stories of beautiful, interesting people. But I never saw it as something that I could personally participate in. And when I moved to New York after Atlanta and still doing digital marketing stuff, I did go to some meditation classes, just a few. And to do the practice, do the basics of the practice. And I found it pointless, really. You know, I didn't give it a try. I didn't really give it enough time, but I remember going to the class and sort of sitting there, not knowing what to expect, but also expecting everything. And like most people explain, maybe I was sitting there in my thoughts and I would think about how bad my knee hurt and I would wonder why I was doing this. And I would kind of listen to other sounds in the room and imagine what other people were doing and experiencing. And then it would be over. And if it did anything, it might have satiated part of my ego that I was a meditator, which, as we all know, can be even worse than not meditating. So that was the extent of my experience with meditation. And after New York, I didn't meditate. And again, it wasn't a practice. It was a few classes in person in studios. But it wasn't part of anything that I felt connected to or part of anything I could identify with. So after that, I started my own company finally. I'd always been doing entrepreneurial stuff on the side, even when I had these more formal, well-paying jobs. And I tried to start a social network type business back when Friendster was still a thing, called Meeple, that everyone pronounced Meeple. So that was really frustrating. That didn't take off. And then, as I had had these jobs, I'd always told the CEO of the company I worked for that I was intending to start my own company. But the reason that I still had that overriding desire to go through everything to start your own venture was because I still, even though my direct experience was that money wasn't it, I had no other path to greater freedom. And I had to believe that if I had more money, then I would somehow reach that state of happiness and freedom. Because what else was there for me in the Western world with my relationships and commitments and my identity? I was not going to leave everything behind and go to India. I had no desire to. And even if I had thought about it, it would have seemed an absolute, total impossibility for a million reasons that I can name. So again, with all of that in mind, what would have been a path to freedom and happiness? I wouldn't say I was deeply unhappy. I would say that for what I knew was possible within the realm of happiness and joy and bliss and contentment and equanimity, for what I knew and what I had been exposed to, I would have told people that I was good. I'm fine. I'm good. Yeah, I mean, life's stressful. We all have these things, but it's all just fine. I had nothing to compare it to. You know, how do you know? How do you know when all your friends tell you they're good and they're fine, and your parents tell you they're good and they're fine, and the institutions tell you they're good and they're fine? How do you know when you have nothing to compare it to? So yeah, I was good and I was fine. And I raised a bunch of money, you know, people trusted me. I had had a great path of consistent, quote unquote, accomplishment with making people money. I was paid because I was able to make them sums of money much greater than what they gave me. And I was industrious and I was just very focused on making things happen. I could pull pieces together from all directions, seemingly out of the sky, and make them happen. So that was my story. And when I said I was going to start a company, one of the greatest failings and one of the greatest lessons was I only did it based on what I thought was the easiest path for my experience to make an exit and create wealth and money for myself. It was no alignment with my passion. I didn't know the word dharmic path. There was no intention. I didn't know what an intention truly was. It was just, here's all the variables of the game that I could see on the table. And I know based on my experiences, if I move and manipulate them in these ways, the greatest path to an outcome, to my quote unquote freedom, with the least friction and the least damage or delay, it's going to be this. And that for me was taking all the stuff I learned in digital marketing online and taking it into the physical world. This is when Google Wallet was going to be the next big thing, you know, and Apple Pay was down the road, but around the corner, and everything was going to start to happen through your phone. This is when beacons were the thing and change everything about the physical world and digital interactions. Newsflash, none of that stuff ended up occurring for the most part. But that was the trend I was following, and I knew that I couldn't do anything online because they would sue my pants off, since I had signed all sorts of agreements as the companies I'd worked with before had competitive restrictions. And so I simply did what I thought was easiest for me to get to my personal version that I could only have known as a version of happiness and freedom at that time. And so my coworkers and previous executives I worked for, they all supported me and they put in money. And ultimately, over a period of 6 years, I raised just under $7 million to create a company called CloudTags. The general idea that you could walk into a store without an app and using all sorts of things, NFC tags, beacons, sound, we could detect your phone and you could start to touch and tap stuff around you without signing in, without giving your name or your email or downloading an app. It was a pretty cool vision. But it was not the right timing, and it was fairly unattainable in terms of our technical chops ultimately. But I had many people that I loved, that I cared for, personal relationships. I put in checks of $5, $10, $15, $20, $50,000. And later I raised money from venture capitalists. But the thing that really kept me going when it was very hard, which was multiple times, was the personal people who wrote the smaller checks and being so determined by the pressure and by the guilt that I needed to give them back their money with a return. And ultimately, that didn't pan out that way. So after 6 years and trying, and we got some great clients and we raised the right money and had some great team members, but you can't control the universe. And ultimately, I had to start the process of shutting it down when it was clear that we couldn't go on and couldn't continue to raise money. We weren't profitable yet. It was very, very hard for me, and to date been the most stressful, consistently long, stressful period in my life, you know, where you're constantly thinking about how you're going to get the next raise done. I wasn't doing anything fun that I liked. If anything, the other people in the company were doing work that I would have considered more fun. And I was just running from pitching VC to talking to existing investors. And my total existence with the company had become fundraising at some point. And all you can think about is, if you don't make that next deadline, as everything is unfolding, the company will shut down. You can't pay your employees. The guys who wrote you these checks will be disappointed in you, and your story will cease to exist. The golden child suddenly would touch something that was no longer a golden egg. Unthinkable, unfathomable. And that's what would keep someone with that identity up at 2 and 3 and 4 in the morning, where they would just continue to try to use their mind to solve problems that could not be solved by the mind. So that long-term period of stress eventually resulted in me having my body sort of seize up on me. In this case, it was severe back issues that didn't seem to have anything foundational to them. It was like the essence of my back just fully seized up the nerves and the tendons to the point where I couldn't walk, and you know, my parents had to help me a bit. And so as I was laying on the couch in my home, feeling completely pathetic and sorry for myself, still stressed out and realizing I couldn't go on like this, knowing how many days I had been living in a completely drained, stressed environment, I didn't know what could happen from here, but I knew that I could not continue to live like this. And I would tell you now in retrospect that that moment of realization, that choice, that decision that I would no longer continue in that way, I would now tell you as part of this story that that was the beginning of my quote-unquote spiritual awakening. I never heard those words, then I would never have had any kind of realization of something greater. But I could tell you now, looking back, laying on that couch, not being able to move or turn over, that I had something break open inside of me that would later blossom into something greater, of not accepting life as this kind of experience anymore. And it wasn't a non-accepting as railing against or fighting anything. It was a sad acceptance that this pursuit of whatever I thought that this was could not continue in this way. Otherwise, it was going to be a disastrous path from that point forward. And the beauty is, I love myself enough to choose to stop the madness. And not knowing any options, not seeing any way forward beyond what I had known, there was still this inner acknowledgement that, yes, you're choosing to not know, but you're choosing something more healthy and free than you are here and now. That was in October of 2017. And so I had started the motions of shutting down the company. We had a tech team in India of about 25 people, and we had had a team in Europe of 5 to 8 people at different times, and we had a team in Atlanta, we had a person in New York, and we had different bank accounts in all those countries, all the things. So to shut down a business like that is not an instant process. The investors had already pulled out and gotten what they needed for their tax write-offs, and I was still left to continue for our one paying client, take that little bit of money and basically use my time to shut down the company and find a new career. So that's what I was doing. It was not a happy period. It was quite sad, quite slow. And it really just gave me a lot of time to reflect on what was going on. So here comes the really interesting part, and I can only tell you this as the truth. And it's almost like I want to embellish it because the simplicity of it is what seems almost unbelievable. But it is what it is. And so I was in that state. I was shutting things down. I would say I was in a depressed state, but not severely depressed. You know, I was just... it was a lot. It was just a heavy time. And as every other year, you know, it was a bit before Christmas, and I had gone to my family's lake house on Lake Lanier in Georgia, and they have a beautiful, beautiful home there. And I was just spending time before Christmas. This was not going to Christmas. This was like roughly a week before Christmas, and I was just there probably saying hello and helping them get ready with some things. And I woke up that morning, normal, same. And after I had had breakfast, I came upstairs and everyone in the family was doing some different projects in the house, cleaning, typical things. And I just had this strong sense out of nowhere. I didn't have anything to do in that moment. I had no direct obligations. And it was just a strong sense of go sit and meditate. And you have to remember now, the last time I meditated at that point was roughly 10 to 12 years before this moment. And I don't honestly think I'd ever sat down to meditate any time in between the two. Maybe. I can't remember it. If I did, it was inconsequential. So it was not a normal thing for me to get an inclination to meditate. And again, this was not a voice. Clouds didn't part. There was no lightning bolt at that moment. It was just an overwhelmingly strong urge and sense that you should go sit in that closet and meditate. And no reason why. Not because you feel this way. Not because if you do that, it's going to help you. There was no story attached to it. It was just like, go into that closet and meditate. And I seemed kind of surprised that even I had the urge to do that, because where did that come from? Why in that moment did I feel that particular impulse? But I did. You know, it's a closet that had no windows. It's just a regular closet you could walk in and has, you know, two rails on either side you can hang clothes. It's probably roughly, you know, like 6 by 10 feet, kind of a rectangular enclosure in the bedroom that I stay in there. And I got a pillow to sit on and I went in there, and it just seemed that the reason I was going to meditate in there was because it was going to be dark with no windows. Not that I had to meditate in the dark. It was just like, that's what the urge and impulse was to do. And so I remember I sat in there and I kind of shut the door, and I remember shutting the door kind of feeling like, it's kind of creepy being in this closet. Why am I even doing this? Why don't I just meditate out there? But that wasn't the impulse. The impulse was to do it there in that closet. So I did. And all I can simply say as part of this story is that when I closed my eyes, doing nothing special in that closet with the door shut in the dark, there was this massive instantaneous expansion of energy. And it was such a fast, visceral, expansive experience that my immediate reaction was to kind of gasp and open my eyes. It would be like, having never had a stroke, maybe I'm having a stroke. And as I opened my eyes, everything stopped. Everything seemed normal. And I just calmed down for a few seconds. I was like, well, that was very unusual. I don't know what that was. And I closed my eyes again. And as soon as I closed my eyes, I was back in this infinite field of energy. And the infinite field of energy, this was not the bright white light. This was the endless set of galaxies, of stars, of the entirety of the universe. And I was still a being, and I could perceive myself moving through this energy field at a very, very rapid pace. And I had no idea what was happening, and I would open my eyes and I could go out of it, and I would close my eyes and I was right back in it. And so as I realized that I could choose to step in and out of this, I felt comfortable enough to stay in it. And all I can tell you was I had no idea what was happening. I could just feel tremendous movement of energy, and my bounds of what I thought I knew I was were shattered. And suddenly from that point forward, completely, totally, utterly limitless. And not in an egoic way, not I am the universe. It was a, oh my God, I'm everything. And I wouldn't have said that in that moment, but there was just this experience of what is happening. That was the overriding thing. There was no clear message. There was no clarity on what the experience was. It was just this massive expansion and relationship between who and what I thought I was as a human body, to knowing that somehow I was in relationship with all of it. And so I just sat there for about an hour. And if you don't meditate at all, even just an hour sitting on the floor like that can really be harsh on your body. And I remember when I was just sitting in this energy field, and at some point, even with my indescribable curiosity, I just felt like I was going further and further and further into the depths of the universe. And I knew it had been some period of time, and I still knew that I was a human with this name and a house with these responsibilities. And I knew I had been in that closet for, you know, a period of time. And I still had these reservations of, okay, I probably need to get out of this experience. I probably need to start to figure out what's going on. I probably need to see if I'm okay. Like, other than just opening and closing my eyes, whatever has happened and whatever is happening, am I okay? That was kind of the overriding initial question. Am I okay? What is going on? What is happening? Am I okay? And I didn't know. And so as I would opened my eyes again. I was back in this space and this experience, and I remember just kind of standing there at the edge of the closet door going, I have no idea what is happening. But what I'm going to do in this moment is I'm going to try to put this behind me for right now, and I'm going to go downstairs and I'm going to have lunch. Because what else am I going to do? What else are you going to do? Suddenly you're in relationship with the expansive energy of the unfathomable reach of the universe. And now you open your eyes and you're in a human body in the closet of your parents' house at the lake, and it's lunchtime. What are you going to do? You have lunch. So I opened the door to the hall and walked downstairs and saw my mom, and she didn't seem to have any gasp that anything looked funny about me. I didn't ask. I was not going to say a word. So her normal question is, what are you having for lunch today? And what would have been normal is to have a turkey sandwich at their house. That was kind of the most common thing that I always eat. And I would always eat meat with lunch and with dinner. That was what I did. And just like the impulse and the urge to sit in the closet with the door closed, even though I hadn't meditated in over a decade, it was as if someone was speaking for me, something, someone, and the words that came out of my mouth were, I don't really feel like having meat for lunch today. And I was really having the experience of listening and watching it in seemingly third person. Like, as the words came out, I was like, what? And my mom responded to me. I remember she said, are you okay? Do you feel okay? Because that wasn't normal for me. And I said, yeah, I think I'm just going to have a salad or something. I just don't feel like eating meat right now. And to this day, I've never touched another piece of meat. And it wasn't hard. It wasn't a choice. It's not a choice. It's never been a choice. I would have told you that time, you asked me if I wanted to be vegetarian. I would have said, sure, I guess. Only because I know it's good for health reasons, but my desires wouldn't have said yes. And if it was on a list of priorities, it probably wouldn't have been in my top 100. So I only share that part of the story because that's how it started. Everything in that moment for the first time, and there were many, many, many times, I realized that I no longer knew myself in the same way that I would have identified previously, which meant that I knew what I liked to do and what I wanted to do. Those are the stories that I had created that I told myself. And these are the people that I like to hang out with. And these are the places I like to go. And these are the things I like to do. And sure, some of the people are really toxic. And sure, a lot of the behaviors I have are probably not the healthiest. But it's fun, right? Aren't we all having fun? You're having fun, right? Yeah, yeah. I'm having fun too. Yeah, yeah. It's all good. It's all fine. It's all fine and it's all fun. And that's a shared experience. That's a shared experience I had always had. So when I said, no, I don't want meat for lunch, and I didn't feel like that, there was no moralistic, there was no ethical nature to it at that point in time. There was no choice that was being made. There was no, I had this awakening experience and now I'm not going to eat animals. It just happened. And I know that might be hard to relate to, and so it might not be helpful, but that's just the truth of this particular experience and how it unfolded. And with that moment, as I ate my salad and felt content with that, I started to realize that whatever had happened, there was far more to it than some type of meditation experience. And again, yes, of course, I knew exactly who I was. I knew my address, my social security number. I could have told you how much money I had in my bank account and my phone number. All that stuff was still intact. But my existence within the same shell visibly that looked like me internally was completely, utterly, totally different. And that's really hard because when you look the same and none of the variables in the equation have changed, you haven't started a new job, you didn't move to a new place, your parent didn't die, you didn't get a divorce, all these things that are social cues that, oh, I bet that person has had some change. I had no cues. I had a closet. I had a freaking closet in the dark. That's all that I had. And so I started to find that for the first time in my life, what I now know as somatic intelligence became the overriding, guiding grace of my life. And what that means in clear terms is it means that regardless of whatever my mind would tell me, my body, my feeling in my heart and in my gut and in all the sensory parts of my body, with an overriding power, would tell me truth. So I could say whatever I wanted to around the concept of what might be defined as fun and fine. And suddenly, if I played that game that was not aligned with truth, I would feel it painfully and thoroughly throughout my body. And so we'll get into more of that, exactly what that experience is, but it wasn't a choice. So when Friday would roll around, instead of going to bars and staying out till 4 a.m. with the same group of friends, suddenly if I pretended to do those things, again, it wasn't moralistic. There was no direct judgment involved in it. It was an incapacity to not align with a greater truth. And the very next day, after this first experience, which lasted about an hour, the very next morning, 3 a.m., which I would never get up at 3 a.m., much less to meditate, wide awake. And I just meditated. It was never a choice. I didn't wake up and feel like I did want to meditate or I didn't want to meditate. It just was happening. It was unfolding with my body and my consciousness as part of the evolution of the universe, and I had no choice but to acquiesce. And so I was sitting for 2 to 3 hours some mornings, and my body hurt immensely. You shouldn't do that. You know, it takes a long time for your joints and your muscles and your tendons to readjust to sitting for meditation. But I was in these deep, deep states of realization and connectivity to energies. Mostly what was happening was a deep cleaning, deep cleaning of my soul and my heart and everything that was in me that was coming out. And it wasn't a choice. It wasn't a program. It wasn't a path. It was just an inability to do anything other than what was happening. And so I started to have these, what I would term as mystical experiences, direct mystical experiences that were non-personified. You know, there weren't any particular deities or any particular guides. It was, again, just unfathomable relation to the energies of the universe and stripping away. And I use the word evaporated. My preferences and who I thought I knew that I was evaporated. It was not a process. It was a moment. In the moment of that first experience, everything was erased in terms of my desires and my preferences and how I was navigating in the world. It didn't happen over a day or a week or a month or a year. It happened in a moment. And I say that because with that experience and that pace, there was great fear. There was this simultaneous experience of deep trust, knowingness that whatever was happening, I couldn't do otherwise. And it must lead to something greater. I prayed it was leading to something greater. But at the same time, it was incredibly scary. Because I didn't know what was happening, and I had no words, and I had no stories. I had no spiritual friends. I had no stories of other people's spiritual awakenings. And so as this started to happen day after day, and I was having these deep experiences, I was finding myself incapacitated in new ways and completely tapping into gifts and abilities that I never knew were possible. And all of it was happening day to day, moment to moment, hour to hour. I remember one of those days soon thereafter, after a meditation, walking outside, and it was like truly what you hear. That was my experience with seeing the world for the first time through my own eyes. No psychedelics, no plants, no nothing, just the deepest essence of your connection to the universe. And I remember looking at the plants and the trees and the sunlight just on my street in front of my house, crying, tears streaming down my face as I looked at everything. It was so beautiful. And I was crying because it was so beautiful. And I was crying because I was like, how much time did I lose to experience this unfathomable miracle, this unfathomably beautiful world that I am? I am part of this world. That was what was unfolding day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute. But my preferences, my desires, any stories I had of who I was, that was not unfolding. That was done. That was gone. I was at the time in a long distance relationship with my husband, and we had been 10 years long distance, London to Atlanta. And I couldn't speak to him about it, sadly, because especially with long distance, you know, I thought he would totally think I was crazy. And there was no context. It wasn't like we were already sharing spiritual practices together or even talking about spirituality. It wasn't a thing for us. So I couldn't talk to my parents about it at the time, and I couldn't talk to my husband. And all I could do was to start to read about the symptoms of what was happening to me. I had not ruled it out that I could have had a psychotic break of some sort. And you hear that with these awakenings, it's such a razor thin line, right? And I understand how that can be an experience that people have and they go through. Like, is this divinity or should I check myself into a mental hospital? I understand what that fine line can feel like. And so that was the process I was going through. But as I read more and I started on my own to read more about awakening, I was like, oh, yeah, this is definitely it. I mean, as I would read, I'd be like, oh, thank God. Thank God I can hear these words from other people. Yes. Yes. That's vocabulary. Okay. Now I know how I would start to even pull words together to describe whatever this thing is. So it was a blessing to finally start to read about these experiences online and getting some books. And then eventually I started to meet some friends and people who had spiritual experiences. But I couldn't function in the way that I used to. I couldn't go to business meetings and pretend like I used to. And that was terrifying because I was applauded for playing a character. And that character no longer existed. And if I tried to pretend like I could play that character, the pain and upset in my body and my whole sensory experience would be so intense that I wouldn't be able to pretend to try. And so for me, that was really hard because that character, although this business was failing, that character as a whole had been built up through meticulous reading of scripts and meticulous repetition of the things that I needed to do and to say to get the cookies and get the rewards and get the wink of acknowledgement. So I couldn't do that anymore. And I said, you know, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Even just to earn money, you know, how am I going to take care of myself? So it was clear to me that this was so intensive and so far reaching that I needed to just take some time away. That was really my only option that I could figure out was I needed to let this experience settle in and see where it was leading. It was leading somewhere. I was not leading it. It was leading itself. And I was some days feeling grace to be the front row passenger and other days feeling disgrace that I was captive to it. And sometimes that feeling could change 5 times in a 24-hour period. But regardless of how I felt about it, it was irrelevant. The experience was happening. And so I started to surrender to following that path and that flow and that current. And I did start to see that as I chose to surrender, since I was no longer driving, that could start to be a very magical place to be if I could trust. And this was not an instantaneous thing. I didn't wake up on day 3 and know that. This was a gradual thing that happened over a long period of time. I didn't talk to my friends about it. I didn't talk to anyone about it. I just sat alone in my home most of the time, reading books and trying to piece together and trying to be quiet. I was just creating space for myself to unfold and to blossom and bloom. however it was going to flower. A flower never knows how it's going to flower. It just does. So I just kept looking at the light and watering myself and waiting for everything to unfurl and hoping that there was some kind of blossom or butterfly or something at the end of this journey. So I ended up going to see my brother in Encinitas. Well, he was in San Diego, but I spent a lot of my time in Encinitas, where Yogananda had gone initially and brought yoga to the West, and met some amazing spiritual friends and beings. And I later went to Africa and saw my husband's family. And ultimately, later in that year, I went to India for a month, and no plan, no map, just followed my intuition, ultimately leading me back to a series of truly miraculous events with Ram Dass and Neem Karoli Baba that really solidified
One sec.
What was happening.